From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Last week, the National Council of Churches and the American bishops urged the Bush administration to avoid war in the Gulf. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss religion and politics, censorship versus moral censure, and radical conservatism with political columnist Gary Wills. Also, Raymond Andrews tells us about growing up a sharecropper's son in rural Georgia. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the reissue of Escalator Over the Hill by composer Carla Bley. This ambitious recording brought together singers and musicians from the jazz, rock, and pop worlds. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the latest police series, Broken Badges, about a group of misfit, psychologically impaired cops. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The leaders of 34 European and North American nations gathered today in Paris for the opening of a meeting on the future of post-Cold War Europe. As Mike Schuster reports, the reduction of East-West tensions may be replaced by the threat of new ethnic and national divisions.
This is one of the largest gatherings of world leaders in the 20th century who have come together to set in motion new European security structures in the post-Cold War era. From President Bush to President Gorbachev, Czech President Václav Havel to French President François Mitterrand, the leaders warned of the dangers now confronting Europe from the reemergence of nationalism and ethnic hostilities. The summit is attempting to create new institutions that can manage the conflicts that are certain to break out in Europe in the future. And when it ends on Wednesday, the summit is expected to promulgate a kind of European Magna Carta, a bill of human rights for the entire continent. I'm Mike Schuster in Paris.
Mikhail Gorbachev's major rival called today for a referendum on the Soviet president's performance and on public confidence in the Central Soviet government. The call came from Boris Yeltsin, president of the largest Soviet republic, the Russian Federation. Yeltsin said his republic, comprising more than half the Soviet population, was ready to conduct a referendum. Speaking in the capital of the Ukraine, Yeltsin blasted Gorbachev's new plan to take control of all government ministries. The Russian president charged that Gorbachev is trying to increase his personal power and ignoring promises to decentralize the government. A chartered flight is now en route to Washington, with several dozen Americans evacuated from Iraq yesterday. More from NPR's Michael Richards.
Mostly women and children are on board the chartered jumbo jet. It left London this morning, where the mainly Western group of evacuees spent the night after their Iraqi Airways flight landed there yesterday. Some of the people on board told of increasing hardship in occupied Kuwait, of Westerners getting stir-crazy after hiding out since the summertime invasion, of shortages of food and health care, of threats, especially against Americans and Britons. Some spoke of divided families, with husbands staying behind. When their charter jet arrives at Washington Dulles International Airport tonight, the evacuees will get priority clearance through customs and then be taken by bus to an airport hotel where the government has set up a repatriation station. Social workers and medical staff will be standing by to offer assistance. I'm Michael Richards in Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street, moving the Dow to its highest point in a month. The gain came mostly in the blue chip issues in thin holiday week trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 15 points to close at 2,565.35. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2 in moderate trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 141 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Political journalist Gary Wills has written best-selling critical studies of three American presidents, Nixon Agonistis, the Kennedy imprisonment, and Reagan's America. He's written for National Review, Esquire, and Time. His new book, Under God, is a collection of essays on the collision of religion and politics in the United States. Will was a Jesuit seminarian, but left before being ordained. Although the Constitution provides for a separation between church and state, Will says religion has always influenced political thinking in America.
Most Americans are very religious in profession and practice. A heavy majority, over 90%, profess belief in God. And most Americans have a moral formation of their views in which ethics are not easily separable from religion. So if you want morality in politics, as most people do, you're bound to have religion in politics. Religious views on the role of the state, of the role of the economy, the role of war, race relations, all of those things have been tempered by people's religious upbringing. Defenders of slavery and opponents of slavery were religious in their fights during the abolitionist period. Look at the civil rights movement of the 1960s. That was entirely a church-initiated and oriented movement, at least in its early days. It came right out of the Black Baptist churches with preachers as the leaders, church people as the original troops. And that is one of the most inspiring episodes of our history. So sure, I think religion always has had a place in our politics.
Let me ask you about a couple of recent religious statements pertaining to the Gulf. Now, the National Council of Churches unanimously approved a resolution calling for the immediate withdrawal of most U.S. forces from the Gulf. And the American Roman Catholic bishops called on the administration to exercise restraint, and the bishop said that a war in the Gulf wouldn't fall under the just war standard. What effect do you think that these resolutions are going to have on George Bush?
I think they're going to have quite an effect, because Bush has been unable to form his own moral argument for the war. You know, it's not as if we were fighting communism. Back in the days when that was the case, many churches went along because they felt that communism was an atheistic system that was a worldwide threat. Harry Truman always used to call it godless communism. And the churches had formed a long-standing opposition to communism. Now that that's gone, the churches seem to be free to voice the kind of opposition that arose in some of them during the Vietnam War. Of course, we've always had a conscientious objection tradition in Quakers and others, but because of our chaplain system, there has been a tendency of war to co-opt religion in American history. I think that's not going to be so easily done anymore. And George Bush, when he can't inveigh against communism, finds that he has to just attack as a monster Saddam Hussein, and that doesn't really give him a moral basis for arousing people. And Americans are very slow to go to war unless they have some crusading or missionary aspect to it. Our tendency not to be isolationist so much as to be insular has made us come somewhat reluctantly into worldwide engagements unless we can feel that we're defending, quote, the free world or spreading democracy or doing any of those other high-minded things. To talk about a war for oil or for resources or for jobs makes us sound too much like the Marxist caricature of capitalist imperialists looking for control of the world resources. So absent his ability to occupy this moral ground, I think that the consensus that's forming between peace churches who had already spoken out and the National Council and the Catholic bishops, that's an extraordinarily broad spectrum of the religious community that's speaking out.
Bush portrays himself as a religious man. Do you think that resolutions like this from the National Council of Churches and the American Roman Catholic bishops are likely to have an impact on him because he professes to religion?
No, because the religion that he is drawn to more now is that of the evangelicals, and he'll find support among them. No, I think it's more a question of the political marketplace, that he will find that much of the territory that most presidents have found they had to occupy if they wanted to arouse the people is being preempted now by this kind of response so early in the game. After all, the churches finally spoke out on Vietnam only late in the process, and I think they learned that they really should tell people to start considering the moral consequences of what they do early on. You know, the whole of the nuclear capability has troubled the churches for a long time because that runs so far ahead of anything like the old just war and proportionality and other moral considerations that people are supposed to weigh when they go into war. So now, religious leaders do feel a certain wariness about getting launched on any war which might take them into a nuclear confrontation off at the end.
Do you think that war would be justified in the Gulf?
I don't know. I don't think that we have a sufficient reason. The closest the Bush has come to having a moral reason is that Saddam Hussein is morally despicable and might have access to arms down the line. The trouble with trying to get rid of a monster is who knows what will replace him. You know, the Kennedy brothers tried to assassinate Fidel Castro for years, and they never gave any thought, as far as the records show, to what would replace him. This focusing in on a villain and thinking everything comes from this one person is a kind of diabolical reading of history, that all you have to do is remove one person and the whole of a nation will be cleansed and changed, and its structure will change and its culture will change. That's simply not the case.
What do you think Bush's real motives are?
Oh, I think they're a combination. I think that he does feel that in the absence of the Cold War, which was a stabilizing force, oddly enough, the so-called New World Order is one in which America has to assert itself early on and try to play a role as a constructive leader. And sending over so many troops so fast was a way of saying, we're not out of the game, we're still a player. Unfortunately, Colin Powell said, we're sending so many troops so fast that the politicians can't dither, which is a quite unconstitutional way of thinking about the way we commit our national resources abroad. But there are a number of things. You know, there's the whole fear of the Vietnam syndrome, so-called. A number of people in the administration seem to think that the only thing wrong with Vietnam was gradual escalation, and that if we have this kind of quantum leap into the situation at the outset, we can treat a big struggle the way we treated Grenada or Panama. And I think they're going to find that that's not the case at all, that the Gulf is not a big Grenada, and just by sending preponderant force, we're not going to be able to have a quick, happy war of the sort that we thought we were growing used to after Vietnam.
You've written books on several American presidents. Are you thinking of one about George Bush? I imagine you're watching him very closely. And I wonder how George Bush, the president, is surprising you, if at all, as compared to George Bush, the candidate, and George Bush, the vice president.
Well, he's surprised me in the skills that he's used. He has been very skillful. For instance, the whole of the canvassing of the world and the marshaling of world opinion in this Gulf encounter, that was really quite deftly done. And, of course, his personal diplomacy with world leaders is something that is not surprising, but nonetheless is a skill that he's developed beyond most recent presidents. It goes very much against the pattern that Ronald Reagan followed, which was to act swiftly and unilaterally so that we didn't even tell Britain what we were going to do in Grenada, though that was part of the British Commonwealth. Mrs. Thatcher was upset. In that way, he's been quite skillful. His tin ear in domestic policy is, I don't know whether I'd call it surprising, but it's certainly of a large scale. His reliance on John Sununu. I suppose if we look back, he did allow himself to be guided in domestic affairs by an Ailes or an Atwater or a Baker, so much so that one of the most indicative things about his whole career is the way James Baker took him out of the race against Ronald Reagan without even asking his permission. That he would allow that to happen in 1980 was a very significant thing about him, that he obviously will let people he trusts act in his stead, even when they do things that are not entirely what he would have done himself.
You've written that you used to believe that one should work for change within the system, but then you lost all faith in electoral politics.
Well, that's probably stating it too strongly. What I meant to say is that we place too much emphasis on electoral politics as if that were our only politics. And much of the most important political activity in America takes place outside electoral politics. In fact, most of our resisted changes of any magnitude, abolition, the civil rights movement, feminism, all came in through volunteer and protest, usually, activity by people who are not office holders. And when you look at it that way, our politics is really a much more interesting and vibrant and rich thing than simply who is elected to this office in a state or local or federal capacity.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Gary Wills, and his new book is called Under God, Religion and American Politics. This is Fresh Air. My guest is political journalist Gary Wills. His books include Reagan's America, Nixon Agonistis, and the Kennedy Imprisonment. His new book is Under God. Several of the essays in your new book are about censorship and moral censure. Let me first ask you to explain where you draw the line between the two.
Well, Nat Hentoff is very good at saying that censorship is something we accuse people of if they disapprove of something or want to prevent its publication or that kind of thing, but that's a misuse. Only the government or some official body, some legal body that has coercion of a police sort behind it can censor. If I say I don't like something and I don't think children should see it, that's not censorship. That's censure. That's my saying I think it's bad, and I have First Amendment rights of free speech to say that. And if I can persuade people to go along with me, then we will reach a consensus of the community that we won't show that, hear that, or whatever. So that, for instance, it's not against the law to call people niggers or kikes or whatever, but social censure inhibits people normally from using such vile terms. And that's a healthy thing. We want that, I believe. We want a community to express its moral preferences and to ask for standards which are not imposed by law but reached by way of moral suasion among people who are giving the matter serious consideration. So I am entirely in favor of censure and opposed to censorship.
Do you think there should be constraints on federally funded art?
I don't think there should be constraints that say, as the proposal by Jesse Helms did, that this or that act cannot be shown. That makes no sense, because art can show any kind of act, and has. You know, it shows rape, it shows torture and mutilation of children. Dickens is full of the abuse of children. Shakespeare is full of the abuse of women. There's nothing wrong with showing particular acts in art. On the other hand, I don't think that it should be the business of political money to fund avant-garde art, because this is a public trust. This is something that the people, the taxpayers, are asked to support in the name of upholding the general culture. And there's something ridiculous in the idea that avant-garde people, ones who don't want to be part of the mainstream, who don't want to be part of the establishment, who want to attack the establishment or whatever, should say, but I can't do it unless the establishment supports me and approves me and gives me a stamp of approbation and pays for it. That seems to me to make no sense at all.
Well, on the other hand, though, it's always been my understanding that the National Endowment for the Arts was created not to support the mainstream, not to support the commercially viable, but to support the more marginal artists whose work isn't commercially viable. Their books aren't going to be bestsellers. Their performances aren't going to get huge audiences, but they're doing important work.
Well, but the trouble is the politicians who are the ones who are responsible for passing this legislation are responsible to their taxpaying constituency, and they should be. Democratic accountability is an important principle in our government. And the idea that the politicians are going to be able to muster an approving constituency behind things that attack the culture seems to me absurd.
But the whole idea was that there would be a panel of experts about art who'd make these decisions. I mean, voters don't go to the booth and decide what's art or not, you know?
Yes, well, I'm not as entirely trusting of the experts in the realm of art as some are. I think that a great deal of log rolling and institution building goes on in those grants, and that there is no right to any of these things. By the way, these are a very recent addition to our national life. We seem to have got along very well without them through most of our period. So, you know, the idea of a democratic patronage of art, which has normally been an aristocratic preserve, is a rather new and insecurely founded one.
You're right. We should choose the images we want to live with, and we should have some freedom to do so. But who's the we? I mean, we each have freedom to decide what TV we're going to turn on, what art we're going to buy and bring into our home, what records we're going to listen to. We're free to turn on or off any radio or television station. So what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I don't know that that freedom is as preserved as you seem to assume. We are under constant bombardment by commercial messages. You know, they've counted these things. How many people are soliciting us in commercial ways and affecting the very atmosphere we live in. So in a culture that is crackling with all kinds of signals that we really don't bid in one by one, we can't do it, to say that it's all a matter of individual going out and turning off particular things that you don't want to hear is a little unreal, it seems to me.
Well, but applying this, though, to rap music or to, you know, Robert Mapplethorpe shows.
Well, you know, with rap music, labeling, as Tipper Gore suggested, seems to me nothing wrong with that. In fact, when Two Live Crew was hailed before the courts in Florida, which I disapproved of as censorship, one of their defenses was that, after all, we labeled this album. Why are you coming after us? And I think that was a good defense. In the case of Mapplethorpe, again, that was censorship, and I disapproved of it. In fact, I disapproved even of the Cincinnati Museum refusing to admit under 21 into the whole exhibit, warning people before they went into the particular exhibit of films that were considered offensive was one thing. But keeping the children out, keeping minors out of the whole exhibit, I don't see how you could justify that.
Putting some of today's moral censure in a political context, do you think a lot of the moral censure becomes an excuse or an umbrella for also cracking down on diversity, on homosexuality, on certain kinds of feminist thought, on certain kinds of teenage inner-city black slang?
Sure, I think that's true. I think that there is an abuse of censure. When I say I'm for censure, that doesn't mean I'm for all kinds. There's an abuse of almost every kind of moral leadership or moral guidance or moral effort. There's an abuse, for instance, of civil rights disobedience, even though it was a very valuable tool during the civil rights period of the 1960s. So saying that you're for a particular moral tool or weapon doesn't mean you're for every use of it. Dr. King didn't approve of every use of civil disobedience by putative followers of his.
Let's get back to the church. The American bishops just met and didn't budge on the church's policy on birth control. And although one of the bishops urged that the church reconsider its policy and urged that the church consider all the opposition to the policy on the part of the laity.
Mm-hmm.
You've said that you think the church's stand on birth control and abortion is obsolete.
Not only that, but on marriage for priests, on women as priests. In fact, the whole constellation of gender sex issues is one that has been distorted by Catholic authorities for a long time. And the idea that celibate men holding a monopoly over all positions of authority and esteem within a church can make meaningful decisions on these matters seems to me ridiculous.
As a Catholic yourself, do you feel bad when you depart from the church's official stand on things?
Well, the official stand is one thing. The church is not the church's leaders. The body of the faithful has the guidance of the Spirit, according to Catholic theology. And I would feel worse disagreeing with the consensus of the faithful on contraception, for instance, than I do disagreeing with a pope.
How do you describe yourself politically now? You went through a period of being considered a conservative, writing for National Review. This was in the early part of your career. Then you kind of left that crowd. yet you don't call yourself a liberal. You don't think of yourself as a liberal. Do you have a name for where you stand politically? Is there a category that you're comfortable with?
No, I don't think categories are very comfortable things if you're trying to think independently. I suppose radical conservative is one that might... Henry Adams used to call himself that. Several other people have. John Ruskin has been called that. It's not a bad term.
Which part is the radical and which part is the conservative?
Radical is questioning authority, and conservative is honoring tradition. They're two different things, by the way, tradition and authority.
Would you elaborate on that?
Well, for instance, the authorities in the church are the popes and the bishops. The tradition of the church is the moral line of thought that stretches back to gospel times and was often at odds with the idea of papal authority or bishop's authority or anything of that sort. There were no priests in the Pauline community.
Do you ever surprise yourself on the stands that you take on issues?
I don't know that I surprise myself. Sometimes I don't know what I'll think about something until I've grappled with it for a while. I think it's a mistake to come to things sure that you know where you're going to come out before you've listened to a lot of different voices.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Gary Wills, and he's the author of many books about politics and presidents. His new book is called Under God, Religion and American Politics. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of the music we're listening to now. It's the reissue of Carla Bley's Escalator Over the Hill, and it's the first in a series of box sets that Kevin will review over the next month. When writer Raymond Andrews was a kid in rural Georgia, his family had 10 children, 30 acres, 2 mules, and a perpetual debt to the landowner. Andrews will tell us about his life as a sharecropper in the last generation of sharecroppers. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Broken Badges, the new series about a group of misfit cops. It stars Miguel Ferrer, who played the ultra-rude FBI agent Albert on Twin Peaks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Today on Capitol Hill, Senator Dennis DeConcini, the fifth member of the Keating Five, defended himself before the Senate Ethics Committee. DeConcini, along with Senators McCain, Regal, Cranston, and Glenn, is accused of acting improperly when he intervened with federal officials on behalf of Charles Keating, the former owner of the now bankrupt Lincoln Savings and Loan, and a large campaign contributor to all five senators. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
DeConcini angrily defended himself before the committee today. He admitted that his political reputation was in free fall, and he accused the committee's special counsel of acting unfairly and of twisting the facts. DeConcini, like other members of the Keating Five who made their statements on Friday, argued that what he did for Charles Keating is what any senator would do for any constituent who was a big employer in his state. After DeConcini's statement, the committee began to call and cross-examine witnesses in the case. Charles Keating, whose savings and loan is expected to cost taxpayers $2 billion to bail out, will not be called. He is under indictment for fraud, and he has refused to testify without immunity. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
State Department officials say a new Iraqi military buildup in Kuwait indicates that the country is not serious about peace. Iraq says it is sending about 250,000 more troops to Kuwait, and that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein and his advisors believe the U.S. would need 3 million men to invade the occupied country. Western diplomats say 430,000 Iraqi troops are now in occupied Kuwait and southern Iraq. Boris Yeltsin, president of the Russian Republic, today harshly criticized a new emergency power structure that enhances the authority of Soviet leader Gorbachev. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
The emergency plan is supposed to let leaders of the 15 Soviet republics share power with Gorbachev in governing the country. But Yeltsin charges that the plan is nothing more than an attempt to strengthen the central government's control over the republic. Yeltsin, whose remarks were reported by the Interfax news agency, did not say whether he might refuse to take part in the new government. As the leader of Russia, the country's largest and richest republic, he's a member of the Federation Council that's supposed to govern in coordination with the president. Several republics are expected to boycott the council, to protest Gorbachev's plan, and to underscore their demand for greater freedom from the central government. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Officials say that violations of federal safety regulations cost rail lines and freight shippers more than $8 million in civil penalties during a recent 12-month period. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 15 points to close at 2,565.35 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says lots of impressive box sets are turning up in stores this fall. Something to think about if you're doing holiday shopping for a jazz fan, or if you're a fan planning on how to spend all your money. Over the next month, Kevin will look at a few of this season's best boxes. He begins with a reissue of a hard-to-find set by composer Carla Bley.
When the 3LP musical extravaganza called Escalator Over the Hill came out on a small label in the mid-70s, no one had heard anything quite like it. For one thing, the cast of performers was weird. The vocalists included jazz singers like Gene Lee and Sheila Jordan, Viva from Andy Warhol's gang, Jack Bruce of the great rock band Cream, and pop star Linda Ronstadt. But this project didn't just look good on paper. composer Carla Bley knew how to use these folks. For me, Escalator's by far the best context Ronstadt ever worked in. Bley wrote her some nice melodies and poked a little fun at her cowgirl twang. By the way, the hillbilly backup singers there include jazz bassist Charlie Hayden. Bley and her lyricist, the Canadian poet Paul Haynes, called Escalator Over the Hill a chronotransduction, whatever that is. Its story has something to do with a seedy old hotel, the stormy relationship between a couple who live there and the city of Rawalpindi in Pakistan. You probably won't figure out exactly how these elements go together, but somehow it all fits. The music works much the same way. Bley echoes everything from Viennese waltzes and Kurt Weill's theater scores to Cream and late Beatles to Central Asian music, yet somehow she gets away with it. That's trumpeter Don Cherry with a little help from violinist Leroy Jenkins. Other jazz musicians featured on Escalator include tenor saxophonist Gatto Barbieri and trombonist Roswell Rudd. But the set's pivotal figure is Jack Bruce, who's a powerful singer and a virtuoso electric bassist. Bley teamed him up with guitar hero John McLaughlin for jams that recall the stretched-out improvising Cream got into. Jazz drummer Paul Motion even does a fair impersonation of Cream's Ginger Baker. Bruce, as singer and bassist, is showcased on Rawalpindi Blues.
Fountain lines fighting for the view. Lonely fish in hats. Parrots so green they make the sky seem blue. Look in my eyes.
And let me stay away.
I could play you a dozen excerpts from Escalator Over the Hill and still not do it justice. It's that conceptually varied. In retrospect, Escalator paved the way for recent large-scale recordings by folks like composer Kip Hanrahan and producer Hal Wilner. They mix disparate musicians much the way Carla Bley does, but her original is still the one to beat. Escalator is now out as a 2-CD box distributed by ECM. I hope that means it'll finally get the audience it's always deserved. Even in a season like this one, where a great reissue or two seems to come out every week, Its reappearance is a major event.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Carla Bley's Escalator Over the Hill, reissued on the JCOA label. This is Fresh Air. Raymond Andrews. Raymond Andrews' family was among the last of the sharecroppers. There were sharecroppers in rural Georgia from 1943 to the end of the decade. Andrews was 15 in 1949 when he left the farm for Atlanta. He's written three novels about black rural and small-town life in Georgia. His new book is a memoir about his childhood called The Last Radio Baby. It's illustrated by his brother, the artist Benny Andrews. Raymond Andrews told me about the arrangement between the landowner and his parents when they became sharecroppers.
Well, the sharecropping deal was whereby whatever you raise, he would get half of it.
The landowner?
The landowner. No matter what it was, he would get half. For instance, you had 20 bales of cotton, 10 bales would go to him. He got everything from that. And your 10 bales, you had to pay him for the seed and fertilizer from that part. And at the end of the year, you sold them that you had anything left over.
And your parents had what, 20 acres and a mule?
Well, we had 20 acres and a mule, then we got 30 acres and two mules.
You say your parents made a profit only once in the 7 years that they were sharecroppers. Did you have enough money for the family to live on?
Yes, but at that time you didn't need money like you would today. The main thing was food, and we raised most of that. And you would buy clothing at the end of the year, your winter clothing, because during the summer most of the kids went around wearing practically nothing. This was in the South, too. So you went bare feet in the summer. And just during the winter, you need the clothing. Warm clothing, that is. And if you didn't make any money from the farm, you could always borrow the money from the landowner, which would, of course, go in on the debt for your next year's crop. So you were constantly in debt. That's what it amounted to.
As a child, how much contact did you have with the landowner?
Very little personally, but I saw him all the time because he was constantly riding throughout the area. He had a car. He would check on his workers, and he had a lot of land, just not in where we were, but just throughout the county and even outside of the county, quite a bit of land. But I saw him quite often.
What kind of man did he seem like?
Mr. Mason? Well, he was supposedly was a good man. He didn't, I mean, for the time, you think back about it, it's funny, like when I wrote that book, I was trying to think, write it through the eyes of the child, what I thought at that time, because it's easy to sit back in the Monday morning quarterback and to say what should have been and what should not have been. But I was trying to write it through the eyes of the child, what I thought. And these things I took for granted. So I didn't have these feelings then that maybe I have now about the setup.
Compare your feelings now and then.
Well, I just think when you think in terms, you were really a prisoner on this sharecropping business. But as a child, though, I just took it for granted that we lived this way, and once I got away, and I can do what I wanted to do.
As a child, how much were you expected to work?
All the time. On the farm, you're expected to work as long as there was work, which on the farm, there was work every day.
So what kind of work did you do?
Well, we did farm work, and during the time there was nothing in the field, you did things around the house like mending fences and building sheds and things of that nature. And also, the landowner had other businesses, like he had the planter mill, fertilizer plant, peach orchards and things like that, so you worked in those. But my mother insisted upon us going to school. So during the winter, we went to school, which most children in the community didn't do. My mother's a bit different in that respect.
Well, I'm sure a lot of the parents thought it was better to have the children working to keep the farm going.
Right, and also to bring in money. So but we had to do without that a lot of times just to go to school.
What gave your mother that faith in education?
Well, she came from a family that was educated, and I mean for the area. She had come from another part of the county, and her father and had believed strongly, her father and mother, and his father, strongly in education.
Did she disagree with your father?
Oh, yeah, they disagreed completely over education at the time.
What'd your father
My father
think?
Wanted it, but he didn't want to stand up for it. My mother stood up. At that time, it was easier for a black woman to stand up for what she believed in than it was for a black man.
Why?
Well, I guess it became whereby black male versus the white male, who was going to win. But the black woman could say certain things with just a woman talking.
You describe your father as a closet reader. He used to love to read, but he wouldn't want anybody to know it.
My father was also a painter, and he also played the guitar and the violin, which is called the fiddler. He did all of these things as a child. He was taught these things. But you didn't do those things. Real men didn't do those things. They went out and they worked and they fought and they drank and had too many children, got too deeply in debt. And you didn't do stuff like women did reading, girls. But real men didn't do that. So he would sneak and read.
What kind of books did you have?
Well, we had mostly magazines. That was very few books. Most of the books I got later would buy from the local drugstore, which had a newsstand, would buy pocketbooks, westerns, mysteries, books of that nature.
Mm-hmm. How did you end up leaving your parents' farm when you were 15 years old?
Well, at that time, when the cotton picking machine came in the late 40s, the sharecropping farms were breaking up. And my brother, my oldest brother, Harvey, lived in Atlanta, so he thought it'd be a good idea if I came to Atlanta, worked, and went to school at night. And so the families thought it was the best thing, too, because to get an inside job at that time was considered a good thing. Inside meant not working out in the fields or the woods. So I went to Atlanta with the idea of working and going to school, finishing school there.
Where did you stay?
I stayed at the YMCA, which is at that time, most country boys, country children, that is, went to Atlanta, would stay at either the YMCA or the YWCA. And it was full of country people.
What surprised you most about the city?
Atlanta?
Yeah.
When I got here, the biggest thing that bothered me later was the buses. Because we didn't have public transportation where I lived in Madison. I got to Atlanta, and I'd heard about it before, and I was exposed for the first time to so directly the racial situation, because you couldn't sit in front on the bus. You had to sit either in the back. And when I first got here, I was so awed by the city, I would get on the bus and sit anywhere. Being a light-skinned person, people weren't quite sure as to who I was, until one day a woman found out and she sent me to the back. So after that, I stopped riding buses. I would walk every place I would go.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How did you start writing?
How? Well, I always wanted to write from the time I can remember. Early, I drew pictures. And I wanted to write, but I thought when you wrote a book and sent it in, you had to have every period and paragraph in place. And if you didn't, it would be rejected by the publisher. So I'd never heard of editors. So I didn't write anything until I was 32. That's when I started writing.
When you left home, your parents were still sharecroppers. How long did they stay on the farm?
Well, no, what happened, the last year I was there was the last year of sharecropping, because the next year, my father started what they call working by the day. We moved from the sharecropping area because this Mr. Mason, he had gotten cotton picking machines to come in there, and so he had no longer had any use for sharecroppers. See, the idea was, one of the ideas of my going to Atlanta was to help save money to send back and bring the family up. So the four oldest children worked and saved money, and later on we sent money to my parents to move to Atlanta. And so in 1953 they moved, except my father. He didn't want to leave, but my mother brought the six youngest children to Atlanta, and so they lived there for the rest of the time.
Did your parents separate over this?
Yeah, they eventually divorced over that, yes. My father wanted to remain in Madison. He didn't want to go to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
He's still there, too. My mother's in Atlanta, yeah. They're divorced now, yes.
Where do you live now?
Well, right now I live in Athens, Georgia. I actually live between Athens, Georgia, and New York City. My brother is the painter, Benny. He has a place in New York, so we switch over. He has galleries in Georgia, I mean in the South, so he comes south during the summer and work in this area. And I go north, and I spend 2 or 3 months there in New York.
That sounds like a nice arrangement.
It is. I like it. I need to get away for a while, and he needs to get away, so it works well for the both of us.
In your inscription for your memoir, you quote your brother Benny, who said to you, "You and I were too naive to know we couldn't make it."
Oh, yeah. We were a bit naive when I look back at things. We just figured that we got out and we just do what we wanted to do and keep working at it, and we would do it. Now, I got to New York, and I found out later that I had never met so many pessimistic people about chances of doing things. And we figured that once we got a chance to do it, no matter what it was, we would do it. And so it's hard to explain. I just had never met so many people before who was what I call downers, pessimistic about doing things. And we weren't, when I look back at it. We just figured, given a chance, we would do it.
Was there more than naivete involved? Did your parents also give you that sense that you could do what you wanted to do?
Oh, yes, yes. We got that, especially from my mother. She said we could do anything we wanted to do, as long as you prayed and you went to school. There's two things we did with her. We went to school and to church. Those two things we did. So as long as you go to school and pray, you do anything. You can be anything you want to.
Did prayer help?
Well, I think, yes, it helped. It helped, yeah. It helped, but I think her also working hard helped too.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Raymond Andrews' memoir, The Last Radio Baby, is published by Peachtree in Atlanta. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams joins us from Washington, D.C. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Iraq has announced they're sending more troops to Kuwait, 250,000 troops to Kuwait, and Egypt says that Saddam Hussein will regret doing that. Boris Yeltsin, the president of the Russian Republic, is attempting to take more power in the Soviet Union in general. In Washington, D.C., Senator Dennis DeConcini makes an opening statement to the Senate Ethics Committee. He says he did nothing wrong on behalf of SNL executive Charles Keating Jr. Also, we'll talk with a woman who's now 86 years old, living in Colorado, who many years ago gave 34 inches of her blonde hair to the World War II war effort.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Saturday, CBS premieres a new police show called Broken Badges. It's the latest creation of Stephen J. Cannell, whose credits include The Rockford Files and Wise Guy. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
In Broken Badges, Miguel Ferrer plays Bojack Bowman, a New Orleans cop who comes to California on a personal quest for justice, sort of the way Eddie Murphy did when he left Detroit in Beverly Hills Cop. Soon after he gets there, Bojack gets a female police lieutenant on his side by getting her drunk. An early clue of how insulting this show is going to be. Another early clue is the requisite authority figure scene, when the Cajun cop is getting yelled at by the chief of police. It's a very odd scene to watch, because both Bojack and the chief are played by Twin Peaks cast members. Ferrer, the star of Broken Badges, is featured on Twin Peaks as Albert, the super sarcastic FBI pathologist. And Don S. Davis, the police chief in Broken Badges, is seen on Peaks as Major Briggs, Bobby Briggs' father.
You're in big trouble, Sergeant. I've already put in a call to your commander in New Orleans.
I just got here. Usually get in big trouble. Take me about a day.
You lost your prisoner.
Just wait a minute.
He's out running around. Now, I got a situation here. The press are all over this. The Cardenas killing is a hot grounder in this town, and you lost the key suspect.
Every TV cop has to have his little personality quirks, and Bojack has lots of them. Psychologically, he has a fear of flying, and of anything else that triggers his claustrophobia. He's also got that Cajun accent, which he uses as a secret code whenever other people are listening.
Well, he's be Grand Chef Mentor, Captain. Mais I don't see a tête repose, and then they put it that I get the few far be gone, and then they play the chivalry, pull the code noir, be calling you at the sugar house, and me I be in the boussolage, yeah?
That's not the way they tell it.
I can believe that.
What did you just tell him?
I told him y'all dress like movie actors and smell like day-old bread.
To solve the crime, BoJack teams up with other psychologically unstable cops, a group that takes high-concept TV to a new high, and at the same time, to a new low. Jay Johnson, from the TV sitcom Soap, plays a ventriloquist who gets violent when people call him short and whose secret weapon is the steel plate in his head. Ernie Hudson, from Ghostbusters, plays a kleptomaniac schizophrenic who, when things get tough, adopts the personality of a tough-talking Texas Ranger. Finally, there's Eileen Davidson as Bullet, a woman who loves danger, wears leather, talks tough, and uses her sex appeal as a weapon. In one scene, she seduces the police psychiatrist, then blackmails him into giving all of these lunatics a clean bill of health.
It's hard for me to confide in men. You're the first one that I feel safe with. I have to tell you, Doctor, it's kind of a turn-on. No, it's like I don't know when I've ever felt such a closeness. I mean, without touching?
The canon of ethics prohibits my having physical contact with you.
The canon of ethics isn't the canon I'm interested in right now.
I know this sounds bad, but it's even worse than it sounds. It's like a B version of the A-Team, which, by the way, Stephen Cannell also produced. The Bullet character is like a Mrs. T. Better make that Ms. And all of Broken Badges plays like a dumb cartoon. The bad news is that Ferrer, in Broken Badges, has a good showcase but an awful show. The good news is that, before long, this show will die a natural death and Ferrer will be free to let Albert rise again.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audie Vablaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Ed White talks about chronicling gay life in his fiction and journalism. Also, filmmaker Pierre Sauvage on his documentary Weapons of the Spirit, about a village which gave shelter to thousands of Jews in occupied France, including his family. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.